Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello!
Jesus.
Wah! Isn't it a good week, listeners? The heat has broken, the summer has begun, we are lying in our hammocks and we are enjoying the month of August, and this is Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week with me, Felix Salmon Effusion, with Jordan Weissman, the Moneybox columnist at Slate, and with Kathy O'Neill, the author of Weapons of Mass Destruction,
woo-hoo!
Available in all good bookstores in about a month.
A little bit less, yeah.
So pre-order it on Amazon. Leave it a 5-star review even though you haven't read it.
Please do.
We are going to be talking about all manner of awesome things. We're going to talk about Uber raising the white flag in China, the largest and most promising car sharing market in the world. We are going to be talking about how employers in Massachusetts can no longer ask you how much you're earning. And we are going to talk about the interesting story of Jet.com, which some people might have heard of.
Felix, I mean, I don't want to interrupt you, but I don't think you explained to the listeners what the edition is this week.
Oh, we need a title.
We don't need a title, but let's go for it.
We could go for the untitled
edition. This is officially the scuttlebutt edition of Slate Money. Why is the scuttlebutt edition of Slate Money is an question which you can send by email to Jordan Weissman and he will answer you.
I was voting for the Felix's heavily caffeinated edition of Slate Money.
Scuttlebutt's just a good word. It's a winning word.
Scuttlebutt is an awesome word and it's not used nearly enough. I feel it's one of those words like malarkey, which we just need to bring back into general conversation.
Agreed.
So Jordan,
tell me
about Jet.com.
Yeah, Jet.com. Jet is a e-commerce website that was founded by one of the co-founders of diapers.com.
Not very long ago. It's quite a young little baby website.
Yeah, I think it went into operation about a year ago. It was it raised about $500 million with really big ambitions.
That's a lot of money to raise before you go into production.
They came out of the gate saying they were going to try and take on Amazon. And the backstory here is that diapers.com was a competitor with Amazon early on until Amazon essentially waged a price war, cut its own diaper prices by about a third, and then bought up diapers.com for about $500 million. One of the co-founders then, Mark Lohr, was sort of sitting around trying to figure out what to do next. And he said, F it, I'm going to go take on Amazon again.
F it?
Is that what he said? He said F it?
You know what? I had a moment where I was thinking about, occasionally we do get complaints about profanity, but he said, fuck it, I'm going to take on.
You realize, I don't care.
Yeah.
So after having failed to compete with Amazon once, he said to himself, I know. I'm an expert in how not to compete with Amazon, so I'm going to do it again.
I mean, but that's not necessarily if you think failure breeds success in any meaningful way, like you learn from your failures previously.
And he found investors with $500 million to back him in this venture.
Failure, guys. He got bought out.
He's about to, but so they decided they were going to take
on Diapers.com got bought out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Diapers.com did get bought out, but it didn't go toe-to-toe and win against Amazon. It kind of surrendered by selling.
But this is standard startup approach to success is to get bought out. A lot of the startups, like their goal is to get bought.
So, yeah, it's the ostensible girl versus the actual girl. The ostensible girl is to win and to become number one, and that's what everyone is funding. And then the secret actual girl is, I'll get bought out and I'll make a few $100 million.
And so Jet is looking like it's going to be a somewhat similar story. So
can you explain what Jet was and how it was different from every other e-commerce?
Exactly. So Jet. Well, its business model has changed a bit over time, but when it first...
Changed a lot over time.
Yeah, a lot.
And over a short amount of time, since it's only, like, it's barely a toddler. It's only a year old.
So it started off, and they were going to be sort of like Costco or Sam's Club for the internet. You were going to pay a $50 fee, and then you were going to get really well-discounted merchandise. And part of it was just they had a discount upfront on everything they were selling. Well, I should say everything that was being sold on their market. Jet wasn't really selling stuff. It was a market for vendors to come onto and sell you toiletries and soap and detergent and towels and diapers and whatever else. But on top of just the discount, they had this thing called a dynamic shopping cart. And the idea was that, you know, everyone pays this premium to get really great fast shipping from someone like Amazon. And there are lots of vendors, there are online e-commerce companies that are trying to ship you things as fast as possible. We're going to use our, you know, algorithm building skills to figure out ways to get you stuff cheapest. To say, okay, well, if you're buying this, you know, item from this vendor, if you also buy this other item from another vendor, fill up with towels and soap, then if we'll figure out the easiest, cheapest way to ship all that to you. Maybe it'll take a little bit longer, or maybe you're going to have to buy more in bulk, but we're going to find ways to shave another 5% off of your order.
So I actually applied to work at Jet.com before they changed their business model entirely.
Yeah.
And this is the thing I pushed back on. I was like, well, how are you going to be able to compete with Amazon, which is famous for like lowballing its providers, its stuff. And their theory was, on the one hand, this $50 membership fee was going to just generate an enormous amount of money.
Yeah.
And then they had a lot of, you know, people who had given them money to start this out, this venture. And on the other hand, they were going to sort of game the shipping.
Yeah.
They really, really thought that like they could get people to buy more because the more they bought, the more they'd save on shipping. And that would be the sort of key to it.
And I can kind of see the logic to that. But
although in the end, they kind of gave up on that, right?
Well, sort of. Well, they kept the dynamic shopping cart, but those words, wow, coming out of my mouth. Anyway, they kept the dynamic shopping cart. But
I have this vision in my head of like some magical Harry Potter shopping cart, which just kind of changes and transmogrifies real time.
That's exactly how they were imagining. But let me just say that the thing that I worried about then and I still worry about now is that both of these ideas, that you get a bunch of people becoming members and that you'd have so many providers that you could really do this dynamic shopping cart well, requires a critical mass.
Yeah.
Which is like everyone. Well, everyone has to be on Jet.com for this to actually work.
And they were planning to lose money for a long time to try and get to that critical mass.
Get to everyone,
eventually.
Yeah.
So they eventually dropped the membership fee and they were just going to rely on the magical shopping cart. I guess... I don't know. You know, it's not clear if they thought things weren't looking like they're going to work out. But Walmart is apparently now in talks with them to buy the company for a rumored $3 billion.
Okay. So literally the day before the rumored Walmart talks started splashing all over Bloomberg, I put out a random tweet and I can't even remember why, but it said in full, remember Jet.com?
I saw that tweet.
And I was like, do you remember like there was this thing and it launched with a huge fanfare and then it kind of just sank without a trace. And then I got a couple of sort of sad replies saying, oh, I still use them. And then literally the next day, we hear that Walmart is thinking about buying them for $3 billion, which, depending on who you read, is either a failure or a proof that it worked.
Well, see, now let's go back to that fanfare you mentioned, because it was outrageous and amazing. I don't know if you guys ever went to Penn Station in, around the time of the launch of Jet.com.
I try to avoid Penn Station.
Well, if you're like a sap like me, looking at the big board waiting for your track number to be called, everywhere you looked for like 3 months, Jet.com advertisements were plastered on every possible surface.
With its weird little umlaut / smiley face.
Yeah,
J.
All that purple. And I was just like, they're spending a shit ton of money.
Associating themselves with the unbelievably pleasant experience of Penn Station. That was the thing. Well, they were like, our shipping is a bit like the trains coming into Penn Station. You're never quite sure when it's going to arrive, but it'll probably get there eventually.
Okay, that's true. But I also think that if you think about the demographic they're going after, the Accela writers is exactly what they're looking for. That makes it strange.
I thought they were going after like Midwestern housewives.
So here's the thing about the story that is a little bit confusing to me. People have been talking about how Jet is going to help Walmart, give them a new brand that will appeal to non-Walmart customers, right? Walmart has a little bit of trouble reaching, you know, upper middle class to wealthy clientele. Their customers tend to be kind of in the below $70,000 a year range.
Walmart has trouble reaching people who don't like shopping at Walmart.
Exactly.
Walmart has trouble reaching people who, A, don't want to get in their car, drive to Walmart, which takes as long as it takes, park in the car park, you know, push their cart all around Walmart for however long that takes, check out, go back, drive home. You know, this is a thing which on a good day for most people will take you at least an hour, and for some people will take significantly longer. And so that's the first thing. And second thing, like, some people just don't live near a Walmart.
Well, also, just in terms of e-commerce, they're supposedly having trouble kind of breaking out of their typical they're having trouble reaching beyond their typical Walmart customer online. And so I've been seeing people say Jet is going to assist them in this, kind of open up a new market. But Jet itself was built for middle-income shoppers, people who really had to worry about shipping costs, you know, who were waiting a little extra time for the diaper was more worth it than getting it tomorrow.
Okay, well, that makes me even more confused, because they were asking for a $50 membership fee up front.
Well, the idea is that you get the idea is that you save $200 over the year. It's like going to Costco again.
I'm just saying, people who are, you know, it's really strapped for money.
But anyway, they're not asking for the membership fee anymore.
Yeah, okay.
That's true.
And I think what happened is that Walmart decided a few years ago, more than a few years ago now, that, you know, it was the biggest offline retailer in the world, and that it was clear that Amazon had become the biggest online retailer in the world, and they needed to be able to compete. And so they spent years and years and years and untold amounts of money, probably not $3 billion, but still a lot of money, trying to build themselves an e-commerce site, which has quietly become a large e-commerce site, which probably does more business than Jet.com, but which doesn't really hit Amazon's radar screen and doesn't really compete with Amazon. And so if they ever wanted to have a hope of competing with Amazon, they needed to buy Jet.com, not in the certainty that now they will be able to compete with Amazon, because there's no certainty in this world, but in the certainty that if they didn't, they never would.
So are they looking for the data or the algorithms?
I think what they're doing is they're making
a
Hail Mary pass. They're saying, if we can compete with Amazon, that's going to be worth just a gazillion dollars to us. And so we are willing to spend $3 billion, which in the context of Walmart's balance sheet is really quite small, on a long odds bet that we'll be able to compete with Amazon. It probably won't work, but if it does, it will be so valuable to us, it will be more than worth it.
I'm just wondering what part of Jet.com is valuable to them.
So this is actually, I've been wondering something similar, which is how Jet's going to integrate into Walmart. Because what Jet does is fundamentally very different from Walmart. Jet, again, serves as a marketplace, essentially. They have some of their own they do have warehouses. They do sell stuff like paper towels as well. But in the end, it's not quite the same as Walmart, which has this big network of its own stores and its whole what it's known for is its massive procurement process, right? Is Jet going to be sort of its own separate thing? Are they going to actually kind of integrate the two operations? Are they going to take expertise from one side and build it in?
My guess is that they are going to use the power of the Walmart buyers to get great prices for Jet. Like, so the price that Jet pays for this stuff is going to be the price that Walmart pays for this stuff, which is the lowest price in the world.
There'll be more of that.
So and maybe then, Jet will be more valuable if it has the Walmart, like, shipping.
And then on the other side, that it's going to use the Walmart. You know, Walmart is an incredible technology company. People forget this. Like, there was definitely talk on Twitter after this came out that this was, you know, a bunch of rubes in Bentonville, Arkansas, who were blinded by Silicon Valley, you know, unicorns, and they're like, "Ooh, Silicon Valley, you're amazing. We're just going to throw money at you." The fact is that Walmart is unbelievably technologically sophisticated. I mean, at least as sophisticated as Amazon in a huge amount of, like, in the deeply important logistics space. They're up there with Apple in terms of how they manage to do sort of just-in-time
especially just-in-time scheduling for their employees, which is problematic.
But they obviously saw that Jet had a bunch of technology that was valuable to them. And also, as Jordan says, a complementary brand whereby people are going to be willing to buy things on Jet.com who might feel a bit funny buying something on Walmart.com. But that, you know, it might not even happen. The last question which I have about this hypothetical deal is, if it actually happens, is that a failure or a success for Laura and for Jet.com?
Well, when I was interviewing, they really seemed to want it to compete with Amazon. And I kind of wanted them to succeed. I mean, we don't want Amazon necessarily to have infinite power. But I would say that this is a failure on that end, at least.
Yeah, it's interesting. The New York Times article about this deal said it was kind of humbling to Jet. And one of the authors, Mike Isaac, and I got into a conversation about that. And he said, you know, humbling is bringing something back from the Latin meaning bringing back to earth, right? Bringing expectations back to earth. So in that sense, yeah, I mean, you know, they have failed in their cosmic goal of taking on one of the five giant corporations in, you know, American industry right now. But on the other hand, a $3 billion exit isn't going to make any of their investors too upset. I believe the last funding round had it at like a B or something like that.
$1.3 billion.
And in terms, I mean, the thing which I'm fascinated by is this idea of like annualized income. Like for Mark Law, the founder, the amount of money he's made in 1 year is just mind-boggling. And I feel like on an annualized basis, it's probably at least as much as Jeff Bezos or like Mark Zuckerberg or anyone like that.
Yeah, I mean, well, let's calm down until it actually goes through.
Exactly.
But it does bring up the following thought experiment.
Thought experiments.
Okay.
They're my favorite thing.
Me too. What would it take to actually compete and win against Amazon?
And on that question, this episode of Slate Money is brought to you by Wondery, which is a podcast company, and it makes a podcast called The Best One Yet. And it is a daily podcast hosted by Nick and Jack, who serve up three of the most interesting business news stories every day and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisition is like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? That's the kind of stuff you find on The Best One Yet. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business. If Amazon is the 900-pound gorilla of e-commerce and it's impossible to compete against them, then we all know what the equivalent is in car sharing, right?
We do. It's Uber.
It is in most of the world, but there's one country in the world where it's not.
An important country.
The most important country. the most important country for ride sharing by far is China.
Why is it the most important country?
It's the most important country for a couple of reasons. Number one, that ride sharing in general works in dense urban areas, and China has more dense urban areas than any other country
in
the world.
That's very true.
It's also damn big.
It's also it also works really well when you can use it as an alternative to car ownership.
Right.
And China is at a point in its development where a majority of the people still don't have cars.
But like, they might have money.
In the United States, there's only one city in the U.S. where a majority of households don't have cars. That's in New York. It's standard for people to own their cars. And if you own a car, the incentive to use Uber goes down. If you don't own a car, then you start weighing it out and say, should I buy a car or should I just use ride-sharing the whole time? And so if you get in there when you can just use ride-sharing instead of owning a car, then the entire country becomes based on ride-sharing rather than on the car ownership. So that's the other reason why China is so incredibly attractive
to Uber. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So for those two reasons, and plus, of course, the fact that it's got a billion people and, you know, only India comes even close in terms of population, for those reasons, it's the huge brass ring that everyone in ride-sharing wanted to win.
Including Uber.
And this is a... this is a winner-takes-all market, as we have seen in the U.S. and in many other markets, that it's all about network effects and liquidity. And so you want to be the number one biggest thing because that's who everyone wants to use, and it's very hard to be a sort of number two competitor.
We're going to come back to that because I actually am going to push back on that, but I do want to hear what happened in China.
Okay.
First.
So in China, there was a big fight between the two big car sharing companies, which were both based on taxi networks, and they were fighting very, very viciously with each other and lost billions of dollars sort of subsidizing each other, and eventually they merged.
So for our listenership, the difference between taxi companies and ride sharing is that the one has an app and the other one doesn't?
Well, so in China there basically is no difference.
Okay.
And so what happened is that you, after the merger, you had this huge number one monopoly called Didi Chuxing. And Didi Chuxing has a vast chunk of the market and it's almost impossible to compete against. And Uber, being incredibly arrogant and incredibly rich, decided we're going to go in there and compete against them anyway because the potential of the money that we could make if we do manage to win is so enormous it's worth trying. So they lost $1 billion a year for 2 years.
And it's fascinating. They were just basically massively subsidizing these fares. They're just paying drivers and not making it back.
Right. So this is where I'm going to go back to this network effect that seems to be all powerful. Because I read the story about how Uber would compete by saying, you know, basically rides today are 10 cents. You know, they would just do incredible discounts. And what would happen to Didi, in case I can't see the whole word, would their ridership would go way, way down. So a lot of the people would opt for Uber on that day of a very serious discount. That seems to me the opposite of a network effect. That seems like, in fact, that the customers are very fickle. They're willing to do whatever is cheaper.
The switching costs are fairly low.
Just download a new app. It's not very expensive to switch loyalty.
I think there is something to say about that. Although the network effect, as far as, you know, I understand it with ride sharing is stronger with the drivers. That's the important part is you have to have
the drivers. The drivers all have multiple apps going at the same time.
Yeah, they can also switch. They can multiple.
So Uber, you know, using these techniques and others, competed very hard and spent $2 billion trying to get a foothold in China and got a foothold in China and got a good 20% of the market, which was much better than anyone thought they would. But then they realized that the only way they could continue to compete in China would be to continue to lose $1 billion a year in perpetuity. And while they probably have the cash to be able to do that, and they had the ability to do that, number one, it was far from clear that they would ever actually win. Yeah. It was far from clear that they would ever be able to make money. And most importantly, it was increasingly obvious that these enormous losses in China were preventing them from going public here in the United States. That just because of this one market, the entire rest of their business, which is worth $60-some billion, was being prevented from its natural next step, which is an IPO.
But color me confused because we've discussed how like these guys kind of avoid going IPO. Like, is that actually their goal?
So there's no particular reason why Uber as a company should be public. It has all of the money it needs. It doesn't need to raise money in the IPO market. It already has, I think, a balance sheet of something on the order of $10 billion. It doesn't need more. So that's not why they need to go public. However, they do have a lot of investors who want a return on their investment. And in fact, recently it's been almost explicitly raising bridge investment to an IPO. It's like, give me short-term money, which we'll give you back when we IPO. And a lot of its earlier investors are saying, okay, it's time for us to start getting liquidity. And the only way that you can offer those investors liquidity is by going public.
I see.
So I feel like this story, and wait, take one time out. Have we actually said that?
No. So can you? So Jordan, why don't you tell us what happened in China?
Yeah. So I was going to say, I don't think we've mentioned. So Uber sold. I mean, Uber sold off to I can't pronounce
Didi Chuxing.
Didi Chuxing. Did I actually get the pronunciation?
Pretty much. And they got a reasonably good deal. Yeah. They wound up with 17% of the combined company. 17% equity in the combined company, which is an impressive thing. And they got an investment from Didi Chuxing. And now they're not losing money in China anymore, so they're a much healthier company. This deal looks pretty good for Uber, even though it does mean that Uber is not going to be a competitor in China.
Yeah, I mean, long-term, having a 17% equity in what's probably going to be the dominant ride-sharing firm in China can't be a bad thing.
I do probably make back their $2 billion investment.
Yeah, one of these days. But
fact, people are saying that now, in terms of the IPO, China has gone from being a bug to being a feature.
Yeah.
That, when in terms of the IPO, investors didn't want to buy a company that was losing $1 billion a year in China. But they do value Didi Chuxing at probably, something in the, tens of billions of dollars, and that Uber's 17% stake in that is worth quite a lot of money to them now, and so they're willing to pay extra for it.
So I feel like go ahead.
Yeah, so there are kind of like two sides to the story, right? Because I feel like this is yet another chapter in the long ongoing tale of American tech companies trying to break into the Chinese market and sort of often failing. And so on the one end, actually there are some ways in which Uber has succeeded here. They gave it a go. They competed. They didn't actually take the market, but now they own a good chunk of the company that did. So that is a hard success, right? On the other hand, we see yet another instance where, like Google before them, like Facebook, Twitter has these issues. I mean, they go to China and it's a combination of going up against a big entrenched competitor and also just cultural issues. One of the things that Uber seems to have found here was that they were dealing with all sorts of kind of dirty tactics they had never seen in the U.S., as bad as things got here.
Partly because they'd never actually faced anything like that kind of competition.
So they learned dirty tricks.
I mean, there were things like, well, one thing, for instance, was that there was this whole kind of cottage industry of scammers who were figuring out ways to get the ride subsidies that were supposed to go into drivers without actually offering rides to anybody.
Ooh.
And it turned out it seemed like it was getting worse for Uber than it was for Didi Chuxing. And then on top of that, they had things like their phantom text messages were going out to their drivers saying Uber was being canceled in China. I mean, there were all these weird kind of, again,
I've had lots of theories going on. Yeah, I've had some theories in the past about like how Uber drivers can game the algorithms surcharges. I mean, sorry, what is it called?
Surge
charging. Yeah, yeah. Surge pricing. And I feel like probably in China, they actually really did those things.
But what we have wound up with now is, I mean, for all that Didi was trying to create this kind of anti-Uber coalition around the world and invested in Lyft and this kind of thing, we have pretty clearly the end game here is pretty clear that there's two dominant monopolies, one in China and one in the rest of the world.
Which is a pattern that plays out in a lot of industries.
And this is going to be very interesting in terms of antitrust globally.
Yeah. So that brings me to my new thought experiment, because we really didn't answer the question, right? What we have here is we have the monopoly in China sort of resisting the competition from the only company that we thought might be able to actually do it, which is Uber. So from the perspective of like customers, right, it's much better for them when there was competition, et cetera, et cetera. And now that there's like a clear winner, which is Didi, what's going to happen to them? Like, when are they – how will they ever have hope for a really competitive field ever in the future?
I feel like when you have a natural monopoly like this, the chances of having competition are pretty slim. Like, there's no one who competes with Google in search. There's no one who competes with Walmart in sort of physical retail. It's pretty hard to compete with Amazon in e-commerce. And you get these natural monopolies. And a lot of the time, one of the reasons they become a natural monopoly and one of the reasons they retain that monopoly is because they behave in pretty consumer-friendly ways. You can say as much as you like about how horrible Walmart is for its employees, but it is good for consumers and it does give them low prices. And as long as it does that, it's the fact that it doesn't have a lot of competition is not particularly harmful to consumers.
Yeah. So as long as they do that. But let me just, like, theoretically, if somebody wanted to compete with Walmart, they would probably not be able to do it on the scale of Walmart. So they'd probably start small fry. They would say, I can't compete with Walmart in every way, but I can compete with them on, say, washing machines or whatever it is. Yeah. And then they would compete with Walmart on washing machines. And what would happen?
Walmart cuts prices.
So Walmart would cut prices for a very short amount of time, buy them up, and then it would be gone.
So that's actually a kind of a tricky problem with antitrust regulation in general, right? Because we think of these giant companies that are kind of general stores, right? Amazon, Walmart. And they're not necessarily a monopoly in any one market. They are not necessarily the dominant player in washing machines. So their behavior in the washing machine market might not actually raise antitrust concerns. Because, again, they're just kind of this general retailer. They don't have 99% of the washer and dryer sales in this country. So at the same time, though, we look at this and, you know, it just seems on its face like, yeah, this should raise some kind of antitrust issue because you have these giant retailers that can just take losses on, you know,
it's their ability to shoulder losses in order to, like, get rid of competitors.
And
that's
so
a problem.
I think there should be some kind of, I think in the future, we're going to have to think about these, how we adjust the way we think of competition issues to account for that.
And I think what you wind up with is the utility model that Uber becomes a regulated utility, and that regulators can regulate it as a transportation provider in much the same way as they might regulate a bus network, you know, so a private bus network. So I feel like there is a solution to this, but I also feel like the sort of dream of market-based competition being the means by which consumers are served has gone out the window. Yeah. That we're in the world of monopoly now.
Capitalism is dead, basically.
Well, I think also that's tricky. The idea of instinctively, I agree that the solution here is to treat these companies like utilities. But Uber has been so resistant to any sort of regulation, and it's extremely difficult to regulate an inherently local company, a company like Uber that's lots of local nodes on a federal level. So instinctively, I agree with you that the solution here is to regulate them like a utility, but that's incredibly difficult to imagine how that will play out, because one, Uber is incredibly resistant to any sort of regulation at the local level. They're willing to pull out of places like Austin, for instance. And you can't really regulate them federally because Uber essentially consists of little versions of itself all around different local markets. So I don't know how the utility model would actually play out with a company like this.
I think we're learning that with Airbnb, and I feel that if and when that problem gets solved, and you're right, this problem hasn't been solved yet. I feel like Airbnb is the first company where it will be solved, and Airbnb is much friendlier in general towards regulators. Then that model might be able to get ported over. We will see.
We'll see.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Kathy O'Neill.
Yes. So today we're going to talk about this new Massachusetts law, which is really interesting to me. And I think probably won't solve the problems it set out to solve, but might have like interesting unintended consequences. So what is the law? The law says that it's now illegal for a prospective employer to ask someone there who's applying for the job, how much did you make at your last job?
It's not illegal for the prospective employee to volunteer this information, but it is illegal for them to be asked for that information.
Right.
Yes.
And the second thing, which is kind of the flip of side of that, is that the new job, the salary for the job that they're applying for has to be posted. So there has to be transparency on what the actual salary is.
But so the first question which I have is, let's say I apply for a job which pays $100,000 a year. That's posted.
Yeah.
And then I go in for the interview and I'm like, I really like this job. I've got to tell you right now, I'm earning 120 grand a year. And so if you offer me 100 grand a year for it, even though I really want it, I probably won't take it. And then they go, well, Felix, we think you're amazing. And they offer me 130 grand a year. That's cool, right? They're allowed to offer me more than the posted salary.
They're allowed to do that. Yes.
Yeah. That's an interesting point.
Yeah. That's one of many ways. I mean, I think this is a cool law, and I think we'll discuss why. But I don't think it's foolproof. I mean, another thing I imagine will happen is a lot of companies will kind of lowball some of their offers. They're going to keep it on the low end of the range to avoid accidentally over-offering online.
Interesting. Well, okay, so let's go into like the argument for this law. The argument for this law is that it's going to help decrease the wage gap between men and women in particular. And the idea there is that men and women are different at negotiating. So there's two different things about it. One is that women and men are different at negotiating. Women especially do not ask for as much as men and often do not get what men get in negotiations. And partly that's because they don't ask, partly because when they do ask, they're punished, like they're hated for it. The other, so that's part of it. That's one of the reasons for transparency. So you just have the idea being if the wage is transparent, then you don't have to negotiate. And you guys just made the point that that's actually not true. The other thing is being asked what you made at your last job means that any kind of wage gap that already exists is sticky. Like it's very hard to get over it. A woman cannot get over it by saying, I'm going to go to another company that pays me better, because they're kind of their history kind of travels with them because they're being asked, how much did you make? And then if they tell the truth, then they're going to keep having that wage
problem. And I have definitely worked at companies where this is the case, that there is a job that we have wanted to fill, and there is the candidate who we've wanted to fill it. And HR, when it goes to HR, they're like, well, we have to offer that candidate some relatively small bump over what they're earning right now. If it was a guy who was earning lots of money, they would be willing to pay more. But since it's a woman who was earning a relatively small amount of money, they're not willing to pay as much because they're like, well, we can get that person for less, so why should we pay more?
Exactly. Yeah. That's the reasoning, and it, generally speaking, works. By the way, I have been asked how much I made at the last job, and I just simply don't answer. I don't know why people are willing to answer this, but actually I do. Like, so here's what I did. Well, I did a thought experiment about this.
Another thought experiment.
Yeah, because that's what I do. That's Kathy right there in a nutshell. I thought about what it would be if all this like data is completely transparent. You know, we would have you know, like LinkedIn. Imagine going to LinkedIn and seeing not only the job listings but all the numbers associated with it. And imagine these are true salary offers. Like, what would I do? I would say, please sort this by salary. Right. Yeah. And I would look at the highest salary for which I am qualified, and I would try to use this information essentially to create an auction for the people to raise their salaries to compete with this one I think I can get.
So
right. But what that means is I think I have power in this negotiation. And when I think about it, when I think about minimum wage jobs, they don't actually have posted salaries on LinkedIn, but they might as well have because it's minimum wage, right?
Yeah, people who earn like hourly wages tend to have no compunctions whatsoever in terms of telling people how much they earn. It's no big deal. The whole like weird confidentiality and secrecy around pay is a very white collar thing.
It's a very white collar thing. This thought experiment made me realize that my happiness at there being transparency or potentially being transparency is completely irrelevant to people who are working like hourly wages. In fact, the transparency for them makes it less competitive. I think it's actually not a good thing for them.
Interesting.
The one thing which I want to add is that this is good for an unexpected group of people.
Millennials, because I have an argument about why it's good for millennials.
Okay, well, first of all, why is it good for millennials?
So the nice thing about this law is it's not just good for women. It's good for anybody who has had an early career setback that limited their pay for some reason. And for millennials who may have graduated, say, between 2008 and 2012 into a pretty down economy, that's the kind of thing that will haunt you later in your career. There have been lots of research showing that if you graduate into a recession 10 years later, you're still feeling the effects in your pay. You're making less than someone who didn't graduate into a recession who's basically equivalent. And so, you know, this could actually erase some of that gap. It's designed to deal with a gendered issue, but I think it has implications well beyond
exactly, because it fixes the pay discrimination on the grounds of age as well as on the grounds of gender.
Yeah.
That there is this, I mean, again, what's something we have all come across, I'm sure, is employers saying, like, we should get some blah, 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 young person to fill this job. And when they say young, they don't mean young. They mean cheap. The two go together in their head.
Yeah.
And maybe this would help. Like, if you think about the job first and then think about how much you want to pay, then, you know, it might actually help older people who want that job, who, you know, are willing to get paid relatively low amounts of money, or, you know, the same amount that a younger person would be willing to earn, but they kind of get overlooked because in the mind of the hiring person, they want the young person.
Yeah, yeah. It's all sorts of things that are interesting about this.
But the one which I wanted to bring up, because I've been thinking about this for a while, is I know a bunch of people, and this was recently in a sort of New York Times workologist column as well, who want to get a lower paying job than they have right now. They're like, I have this like super high stress job right now, which takes me away from my home too much or too many hours, or it's too much management and I want to go back to actually doing stuff instead of managing people, and I want to like move back down the org chart a bit. And it's really hard for people to do that.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because that goes right into what I wanted to mention, which is I looked into the question of, according to famous, you know, economists like Claudia Golden, like, would this actually address the wage gap?
Yeah.
And I think the answer is pretty much very, very little, if at all. And I think in the ways we discussed, it will sort of incrementally affect it in a positive way. And I think it's a good idea for millennials as well as for women. But when you think about what is the wage gap really, what she did, Claudia Golden, she had this great Vox piece, or maybe she didn't, but her work was referred to. She looked at the wage gap over time, and it's white collar workers. But basically the wage gap for young people right out of like a business school degree is relatively small, women versus men. And then by the time 9 years later, it's 60%. Like women make 60% of what men do. It's enormous. But if you didn't have children, if you further divide the groups into three groups, women with children, women without children, and men, then the women without children make 94% of what men do. It's like almost entirely about the kids.
And this is the point that Ivanka Trump was making. I mean,
The final thing is the wage gap closes again in women's 50s and 60s. So they actually start. So her theory is like, actually, women aren't bad at negotiating because they negotiate early on. They negotiate later on. It's in the middle when they're having kids that they're screwed.
I do think that this does. And that study was specifically about business school grads, too.
Yeah, so, that's true.
But I do think this erases some of the golden problem, because, let's say you get off the treadmill for six months to take care of your kids, right? Then you come back to your consulting firm or whatnot, and you've kind of lost some promotion opportunities, but you still fundamentally have the same skills as the other guy. And maybe, you have the same title and the same basic job, but you're making less. If you both then go for a job at the same new employer who can't ask you what you're making, this should help.
That's right. I'm not saying it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
But I want to get back to the sort of Claudia's conclusion, which goes right to Felix's thing about people who want to actually earn less. She said the way that really unequal pay happens is in specific industries, like business, where working extra hours, and in particular working childcare hours, is unreasonably rewarded.
Yeah.
So it's not just like if you work 10 hours instead of 8 hours, not just rewarded because you have those extra 2 hours, but like actually those extra 2 hours are the critical hours to become a big dick.
The idea is that working longer out, the more hours you work, the more you make per hour in those industries.
And it's exponential. So if you make, if you consistently work 10 hours instead of 8 hours a day, you make three times as much as people work 8 hours a day.
This isn't going to fix everything about the wage gap. I do think though that this is...
Wait. Can you not interrupt
but,
me?
So the goal that Claudia mentioned this fact, and she also mentioned that some industries have changed. They used to be like that, but they're no longer like that. So her actual thing is to make more industries more like that. So what does it mean to be more like that? It means make your industry so that it doesn't matter exactly which hours you work or how many hours on a given day you work, but that you do good work.
Yeah, I mean, the golden idea of making everything work like a pharmacy and every worker being substitutable with another worker, it's a little bit, the thing about it is it's a little bit utopian. I mean, I love the research that went into it and I've written about it, but, you know, I think that, again, it's that kind of thing's a long way off, whereas the sort of thing that Massachusetts is doing is something concrete.
I actually disagree. I think basically what she's saying is if you commodify a job.
Yeah, it's really hard to commodify.
It becomes more equal.
It's really hard to commodify certain jobs, especially the ones. And I mean, that's a long evolution that you're talking about in industries.
Well, it's
but
interesting.
I also think that it's easier than people like to admit. The people in those jobs love to think that they're uniquely capable of doing their jobs and they're not in anything commodifiable. But honestly,
yeah,
it's probably commodifiable.
I'm totally with you.
Everything except for like fund management, really.
Well, let's talk about that.
To be continued.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This is now the numbers round. And I feel that Kathy should go first with her number.
Okay, I have a crazy number, which is... very boring, but crazy. 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So 50% of people in an emergency evacuation on an airplane grab their bag. And this is against explicit instructions by the flight attendants and the pilot. Leave behind your bag.
They're free riders, right? They're like, if no one else grabs their bag, I can grab my bag and get safe and have my bag.
Yeah, so they did a study on this. And these are like real emergencies, not like we're practicing here. And they found a bunch of examples with like videotape evidence of people grabbing their bag, like slowing down the flow of people. Like, and this is it's mind-boggling, it's dangerous, it's crazy, and it's like when you have to choose between your life and your laptop, you choose your laptop consistently.
But also like on an individual level, I can understand the logic, although I'm sure it's not like thought through in an actual emergency. But the logic is that, you know, that person in front who's holding me up by grabbing their bag is costing me my life potentially.
Yeah.
But me grabbing my bag is probably not going to cost me my life. It might cost the person behind me their lives. Yeah.
Thank you for that. You really broke it down for me.
I've had this conversation with myself so many times about whether or not I would grab the bag on the plane. And
the answer is no.
I think,
Don't do it, Jordan.
Yeah, and now every time I have that inkling, I'm just going to think of Kathy's disapproving glare.
No, you know what? I want there to be a law. I want the federal law to be like, the flight attendants can be like, if you grab your bag, I will shoot you in the head. And then maybe people won't do it.
But that's also going to, that's going to slow down the line too.
All right. My number is 119,756.
Wow.
Which is a good number. I feel like that's one of the best numbers we've had in a while.
It's a good number.
119,756 is the number of Bitcoin that were stolen from Bitfinex.
Yeah.
Bitfinex. So you may or may not remember that the world's biggest Bitcoin exchange, Mt. Gox, got hacked a while back. And so now there's been a bunch of other Bitcoin exchanges which aren't nearly as famous or as well known as Mt. Gox. But the biggest of them all, and the number one Bitcoin exchange in the world, is this one called Bitfinex. And what happened? It got hacked. And 119,756 Bitcoin were stolen from it, which works out to, depending on the value of Bitcoin this second, somewhere in the region of $65 million. And
the, I thought this is all about keeping track of stuff. Like, how could someone steal it?
So a theory I've seen about blockchain now is that the inherent problem with it is that the more nodes you have on a network, the easier it is to hack it, essentially. Or there's more opportunities to hack it. And since blockchain is all about distributing a network, that leaves it open to security threats.
So
the fact is that virtually every major Bitcoin-based anything has suffered some kind of fraud or theft or something like that. And if anyone really believes that they have unhackable security and that their Bitcoins won't get stolen, all I can say is think again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So my number is 880 billion. And that's the number of assets under management, according to the Financial Times, in the computer-powered hedge fund industry. And what does that mean exactly? It's like, apparently, it's kind of a combination of hedge funds that are basically just trading on algorithm. Like, they have developers who come up with an algorithm that's going to look at the market and say, okay, do this with bonds today.
That would be like Rentec, something like that.
And then the other half is sort of like the computer-assisted part, where you have people who are – you have human traders who are still making decisions, but they're heavily influenced by what the program's telling them.
Well, wouldn't that be like everyone?
That's kind of what I'm wondering.
I was going to say, is
that like every single trader with a Bloomberg?
So this is not a thing. So this is what I wanted to bring up, is how much of this is just marketing and how much of this is real. I'm curious. And to the extent that it's real, I'm wondering how much it actually kind of commodifies – well, I mean, it does make traders – it doesn't just commodify them. I guess it makes them obsolete in a way, and the real value in the industry becomes the programmers. But
I just feel like this has been going on for 25, 30 years.
I mean, yeah, this is – ever since Mike Bloomberg invented his terminal, which would allow you to use a computer to trade bonds better.
I think it's –
So what is the actual figure, 880 billion?
In the computer-powered hedge fund, 880 billion of assets under management. So my impression is, from what I've seen, is it's more about the actual computers doing the trading themselves. Mm-hmm. So that seems like that is the kind of –
And that's a lot of reasonable high-frequency trading there, which, but I feel like high-frequency trading doesn't have a huge amount of direct AUM.
Yeah.
But, yeah. No. I think I'm with Jordan is that this is a largely meaningless number.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that, too.
So, okay. Well, I still want to kind of come back to it later. I think
we'll come back to it at some point, but not this week, because that's it for us this week. I'm sorry, but no more Slate Money this week.
No more Scuttlebutt.
No more Scuttlebutt. Thank you all for listening to Slate Money, and do subscribe, because that way you get to listen to all of them. Just search for Slate Money in the iTunes store. Leave us a review there. Tell everyone how wonderful we are. Write to us. The email address is, as ever, slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Virilyn Williams in DC, who produced this week, to Steve Lichtai, who's also in DC, who's the executive producer. Maybe they're going out for a drink or something later. Thanks to the executive producer, Andy Bowers, the other executive producer, the guy who runs the entire Panoply empire, which can be explored at itunes.com/Panoply. And yeah, we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.